Hi everyone, I'm Beth, I'm an alcoholic. So last week we started reading the family afterwards, and for me, I really love these back chapters. I think sometimes they get overlooked so often. You know, it's a lot about what I put my family through, their behaviors towards my behaviors as an alcoholic, but there's tons of principles in here that I've learned how to live by. So we ended on page 130. So if you want to flip over to page 130, we're going to start at the very first full paragraph that they have there. Again, my name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is By the Book in Atlantic Highlands, and my sobriety date is August 1st of 2017. So it says, those of us who have spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childness of it, right? And I find out what spiritual make-believe looks like to me when I'm going through a lot of my four-step. Right? If you would just, even when we talk about in the third step when we're reading it, life would be wonderful if you just knew what your lines were when interacting with me. I would never get angry. Right? Life would be wonderful if you got the memo in the morning and knew how to treat me. Life would be wonderful if you would just drive right. Right? Get out of my way. Don't you know I have to be somewhere? See, I've always been playing God in my own life. Boy, if you were wrong, I was going to tell you all about it. You know, there was no filter for me. There was no peace in my life. I mean, I was constantly just bringing about problems, but I didn't think so. I called my anger justified, right? I need to straighten them out. Don't they know how wrong they are? Well, the truth is I've been wrong because I didn't know that that's not what I'm supposed to be doing, that God's judge, jury, and executioner, not me, but I assigned myself that role. So the spiritual make-believe, right? The only time I ever prayed to God was, you know, sitting in the back of a cop car, God, get me out of this. And when God didn't wave his magic wand, it was like, well, there is no God. You know, I had a lot of fantasy thinking about what God should look like. I had a lot of fantasy thinking about what my life should look like. I was always comparing it to that Hallmark card, right? And I had no idea that I did this because a solid self-appraisal is not enough. So when I actually put down in black and white in a four-step what I actually show up behaving like, I begin to digest some big chunks of truth about myself that I had no idea about. The truth is that alcoholism is this judgmental mind, this critical blaming. I'm a pessimist and a victim, and it's always your fault. You know, I never wanted to look at my own actions or behaviors, or if you were wrong, you know, I may have showed up behaving wrongly back towards you, but I couldn't see that. I was just so focused in on you. And so Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that the only mistake that a loving God made is that my eyes look outwards and at you, what you're doing, and how you're behaving. And what Alcoholics Anonymous does in this program, in this work that we do here, is it turns my eyes back inwards on me. And then it helps me grow. And in the 11th step, improve and sought are the two most important words for me. I have to improve. It's not just get in my car in the morning, mutter the serenity prayer underneath my breath, and go to work. I am looking to improve conscious contact, continually seek a power greater than me to grow that relationship. In the beginning, it's just I'm doing what I'm told. I'm taking suggestions and directions from a sponsor that I don't even like or want, you know? But I'm doing these things, but I'm still living in spiritual make-believe. I was when I showed up here, I had a probation officer. I was in a court-ordered IOP program, and I was in a lot of trouble at work. They had wanted to fire me on Monday when I showed up, my first day of sobriety, the first day I actually hit my knees and asked God that I didn't think that I needed to help me stay sober. You know, and I go to this IOP program, and I'm only supposed to be there for 3 months. But they're drug testing me, and as they're drug testing me, I'd had a whole period of about 2 months of everything's fine, I'm doing what I'm supposed to, and I really continued to do what I was supposed to, but at the third month, they told me that something was coming back in my urine test. Things that I'd never heard of, and believe me, I was an avid drug user, I could mix chemicals together myself pretty well, and you know, and I was really shocked and surprised, and I would call my sponsor, and I'd be like, this is so wrong, I can't understand, why is this happening to me? And I didn't know that I'm singing the victim song. You know, I call my sponsor and I tell her about some problem, and she would just start singing me, 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 like the opera singer, because I had no idea that I'm always a victim in my life and that things are going to happen in life that are quite unfair, because that is life. But I don't like unfair things, and I don't like being uncomfortable, and I will drink over those things. And so it didn't just happen once that I came back with these really minute amount of drugs that I didn't, you know, even understand what they were. It happened to me 3 times. And so they're calling my probation officer who wants to throw me in jail. And so I'm really upset, my hair's on fire, and I am the ultimate victim sitting in IOP, and my sponsor would be like, well, pray on it. Beth, your truth is good enough, and I'm telling these people my truth. I am not using drugs. Now I'm actually showing up. I'm a sober member of AA. I've got a sponsor. I've got a home group. At 16 days, I got a commitment making coffee. I'm taking suggestions and directions that I don't like and understand, and I'm thinking, why me? And I'm thinking I'm going to go to jail. And all she would say is pray on it, and then I would be pissed off at her for that, or that my truth was good enough. See, I have spiritual make-believe. This should look differently than it is, because I've spent my entire life shoulding all over the place. I should, they should, the world should. That's a key word to me in sobriety. I know that when I got a case of the shoulds, that I'm playing God. And our third step says, we can't play God. I had to quit playing God. It's not my job anymore. You know, I never knew what humility was, and it definitely wasn't something even desirable when I got here. A humility in the 12 and 12 is described as a desire to seek and do God's will. Well, I didn't know what that was, but I do today know that God's will for me is peace. So even as I go through things in life today, because life does show up, and it is, I like to say, unfortunate, instead of making myself a victim and saying, it's unfair, I had to change some of that words. Just like I had to stop being so dramatic with my vocabulary. Always, they always do that to me. Never, nothing ever good ever happens to me. Right? There's certain words that I had to get an entirely new perspective on and use different words in my vocabulary so that I could stop victimizing myself and having these big catastrophes that I obviously catastrophize. But I have spiritual make-believe on how things should look. They should be different than they are. Don't you know that you're not supposed to do that? How dare you say that to me? And then I'm spiritual make-believe in the victim that I have some kind of power to make things look differently than they are. And that's what I said. I used anger a lot. Anger was my go-to. I was called an angry child. That was the only power that I had, was anger. Anger is really fear, but I never knew that because I never went through a fear inventory. But anger felt like power to me. It still feels like power to me. I'll get angry with my mom because I want to guilt and manipulate her into acting right. So if I get angry with her, maybe she'll act right. The truth is I'm afraid that I may not get what I want, what I need, something's missing. That's the scary story that I tell myself because I lived life based on what's happening or what's not happening. Because I've got a script written for everything, and I don't know that. And I still play those scripts in my head, old ideas and beliefs. The result was nil until I let go, absolutely. My go-to script that I had no idea was that I'm afraid that I'm not enough. And so I will have to use my smarts to set you straight. Don't you know what I know? Right? I'm a big book, you know, you got that wrong. You know, and I will use that to con and manipulate people to get them to act right or to show them how smart I am because the truth is I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex and I want you to feel good about me or know that I know something. Because the bondage of self was really what we call the ego. The ego believes that I'm a nobody, so it has to prove that I'm a somebody. And that's what captures me. That's alcoholism. It captures me, and it makes me act based on the belief that I'm a nobody, and I got to prove that I'm a somebody. And so this is why I need a God in my life. We get newcomers all the time come in the room. They're like, I just don't feel like enough. And I'm like, you're not. You're not because you need God. And you never will be, because we always feel that way until we turn to God and we develop a relationship with a power that gives me the God confidence, that gives me the God esteem that I need. But this is why I have to do these daily practices and disciplines that I'm given. Because otherwise I will fall victim to those old ideas and beliefs again, that I'm not enough, that I'm not going to be loved, that I'm not going to be respected. And then I will act in ways where I need you to respect me, and I will fly off the handle, and I will say things that just don't sit right with me anymore today. Before I just called them justified, but Alcoholics Anonymous made me realize these things land on me, and they just don't sit right with me, that I make a lot of amends today. It says, this dream world, and I do believe it is a dream world, right? I tell myself a lot of stories based on 10% of the facts. I write 90% of the story. Jill looked at me wrong. Bam, I've got a whole story. You know, she may not have even looked at me wrong, but I think maybe she didn't acknowledge me. I will tell myself a story based on that, and I will act in ways to try to get her to love me or treat me right. And I don't realize that I do that until I write inventory often. I'm an approval addiction junkie. And I can see it in other people today. My husband and I went to a restaurant this morning. The guy is in AA who owns the restaurant. The last time we were there, my husband gypped the guy in a tip and felt awful about it. He thought I was leaving a tip. He thought, you know, the credit card. He left something on the table, didn't realize that I didn't leave the tip, and then he felt awful about it. So this morning when we go in there, I said, I'll leave the tip on the table of cash, you know, because we don't want him to get taxed because I'm so wonderful, right? There's my approval addiction. Right, well, my husband gets up to the counter and pays for it and tells the guy, because the guy's at the counter ringing us up, and he goes, I just want to let you know I left a tip on the table, because he wanted to put it on the credit card. And see, I want to say something about that. Why do I want to say something about that? Well, you don't have to do that, Jason. You don't have to over-explain yourself. Because what he has in him is what I also have. And so, you spot it, you got it, I said last week. The things that irritate me about you are most possibly in me. Or the things that irritate me about you, I got a girl in my home group. Boy, is she an approval addiction junkie. She's just one of those suck-ups, right? And boy, she gets underneath my skin. Why? Because I want to deny that that's in me. And I just want to look at her and be like, oh, I don't like her. She's just annoying. But the truth is when I turn that back around and I stop denying those things are in me, I get to the truth about me. And then I'm able to have compassion for me, and then I can have compassion for you. The golden rule is that I do to myself what I do to others. So if I'm judgmental, critical, and have a lot of rules for myself, I'm going to be judgmental, critical, and have a lot of rules for how you should be. And so these are the things that I'm constantly looking at in sobriety because I default to these things. 6 and 7, I don't like to run around and say I'm a defective character. I like to say today that I have things that I default to. These are my defenses in life. And I default to these things often. It doesn't make me bad. It makes me human. But thank God I have the awareness. In step 6, I have the awareness that this seems objectionable to me. And in step 7, I have the humility when I have that awareness, hopefully, to go to God and ask God to help me see things from an entirely different perspective. Otherwise, I'm living in this dream world and I got the shoulds for you and you should, you know, you should be acting right because I placed my security based on what you're doing or what you're not doing. And that's the insanity of this dream world that I live in. So it says this dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. You know, I think I touched a little bit last week. I've got a lot going on in my life, a lot of emotional things that are coming up for me as my mom is aging. My mom wanted to kill herself. My mom ended up in the hospital after shattering her arm. I don't know if she purposely did that or not, and I will never know that. My mom ends up in the hospital, and I go running over there because, you know, I'm trying to be a good daughter. But my mom calls me things like evil and the B word, and I'm trying to do the right thing by my mom to help my mom. My mom needs to go in a nursing home. She's screaming bloody murder. She doesn't want to participate in picking that nursing home. She says, you do it. I know that if I do it, there's nothing I'm going to pick right because that's how my mom operates. They like ourselves, as the 4-step says, they like ourselves are perhaps spiritually sick. The whole family has been affected by this disease of alcoholism. That's why we have a sister program called Al-Anon. My mom is just like me in certain ways. But I like to say that my mom has taken it to a whole nother level because I don't want to look at me. And it's easier to victimize myself and play the victim to her when really what she's doing is she's playing the victim to me. And I'm doing the same thing, playing the victim to her. How do I get to a place of God consciousness? Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. One of my mantras in meditation that I have to do often, because otherwise I will go into that mind of judgmental, critical, blameful, is how can I judge a brother or sister when God's eyes are staring back at me? See, but my mom is captured by this mental illness that I didn't know that she had until a couple weeks ago. My mom can't show up and she can't love me the way I wish she would because I have old ideas and beliefs about what a mom should be. moms should be loving, kind, nurturing. They should take care of their daughter's emotional states. I shouldn't always have to take care of hers. That's my old idea. And then I make my mom my higher power. Where she has the power, she has more power over my mind and my emotions to piss me off a little. And so this is why I need God in my life every day, to realize that I have a loving God, and that God is the Father, the Son, the Director, everything that it says in our third step prayer, so that I get right size, that my mom is not God. She birthed me. Yes, I have a role to play, as our fourth step says, that God has given me a role to play in her life. But in my life, it's just easier to cut people out. I'm sick of this. You say this enough to me, I'm done with you. But God has assigned me a role of daughter. How do I do that? I do that with this 12-step program. I do that when I'm able to spiritually be available to make choices, but I'm not a saint, right? And I stay in conscious contact with God when I see my mom, so that I know when it's time to leave. Because when that attitude starts changing in me, and I'm about to be a terror and unleash my personality on her instead of principles, it's time for me to go. When I'm making her my higher power, it's time for me to go. But then what ego does is steps in and tells me that I'm bad because I can't put up with her for a long time. That's not the truth. The God consciousness that's in me says, you are a loving daughter, and it's not your problem that you can't handle for a long time. Beth, you're showing up and you're staying for 10, 15 minutes at that hospital or the nursing home. But I've got to watch what the mind starts shattering away in me and starts telling me that I should look different than this. I should be more spiritual by now with 6 years of sobriety. I should know what the spiritual principles are to show up. I should be able to show up and put up with my mom. The truth is I don't think God expects any of us to be perfect. That's why I said, when I feel like I'm not enough, this is where I need God in my life. This is where I need to get out of that spiritual make-believe that I should be able to handle all of this. I'm still human, and I still suffer from the human condition. God loves me as I am, not as I should be, because none of us are as we should be. And that's why I have a loving and forgiving God today that has got a lot bigger than what I walked into this program with and continues to grow, so that I stay right size and I'm able to show up for the, you know, people like my mom, who I would rather just say, you know what? She just craps all over me all the time and says just mean, horrible things. Why even bother with her? It's much easier. We see it all the time on Facebook, right? Just get rid of toxic people in your life. Much easier. But I think God asked me to take the high road quite often in my life. Not to put up with it all the time. Not to, you know, be an approval addiction around my mom. You know, I read a great book by Joyce Meyer the other week, How to Love Difficult People. And it says, she didn't love her mom as a daughter would love her mom. She loved her daughter. She loved her mom as God would have her. And this was coming from a woman whose dad sexually abused her. And in the end, she ended up making sure that they had a roof over their head. And she ended up having a conversation with her mom and said, why did you look the other way? You know, she knew that this horrible thing happened to her as a young daughter. But she had to get right with what is my role to play as a daughter, and how would God have me be? And that's what I'm trying to get in contact with these things, so that I don't live in spiritual make-believe in a dream world and run my own show. Self will run riot. It's just much easier to cut everyone else out of this world. But I'm not living in reality, because I can't do that at work, you know? So I think God asked me to adjust to people and get spiritually right-sized with God instead of just running away from everything. Where does God want me to be, and what role does he have me to play? I love this next section. It says, we have come to believe he would like us to keep our head in the clouds with him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on the earth. Right? And that for me is the pink clouds. You know, I often go through things throughout my day, and they just seem like the worst of the worst things. At my job right now, my boss took a new job, and I love my boss. She's been amazing for me. And then her boss got fired, and I know that I'm going to be reorged, and I don't know where I'm going to end up, and this is the 3 years and three different jobs. And so the story starts playing, and it's a really scary story about what may or may not happen. And what this is asking me to do is to keep my head in the clouds with God, but my feet firmly planted on the earth. Sometimes when these stories start playing in my head, and I know that that's the insanity, Jill, you talked about that last night, right? Sometimes I have to look up and I just go, God, am I okay right now? Because I'm always okay in this moment. It's just the noggin starts talking. It takes me out of the moment with a fearful, scary story. And I'm no longer in the present where my head is in the clouds with God and my feet are feet on planet on the earth. It's a scary story and I want to come back to the present moment. That is the place that I meet God. Not in the head that's telling me a fearful, scary story about what may or may not happen. So that's one of the beautiful things that I love about that line. It says, that is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. You know, I call my sponsor with some problem. You know, she'd start singing like the opera singer. But at the end, she would say to me, who are you calling? You know, Beth, why don't you call someone and say, how are you, and not talk about all the stuff that's going on in your life? See, I always live my life based on the way I felt. I don't feel like calling anyone. Don't you know my problems are important and matter? You know, but then when I would call someone all of a sudden and not talk about my stuff, God shows up in these conversations where all of a sudden I may be helping you or listening to you so that I'm not thinking about me. So where can I be useful to others? And I would think, well, I don't feel like calling them, especially in the beginning, that phone weighed 1,000 pounds. And, you know, don't you know all my problems I have going on? But I never knew that I lived life, I worshipped my feelings. It's like every year I join the gym January 1st, I'm dedicated and I'm going to get sexy, thin, and everything else, right? And then I get up in the morning, the alarm goes off, and I think I'm going to go to the gym. And then I wake up and I go, I don't feel like it. And that's the way I've lived my life, and I had no idea I lived my life worshiping my feelings based on the way I felt. I don't feel like picking up the phone and calling you. I don't feel like going to a meeting. I don't feel like driving up here because I have a headache. And when I start taking actions contrary to the way I feel, my feelings change. That's the miracle of it. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is take these actions. And you will have a spiritual awakening as a result of taking these steps. And I've slowly stopped basing my life based on the way I feel. Feelings are uncomfortable, especially in sobriety with the things I have going on with my mom. I'm really sad for my mom. I'm really sad and it hurts sometimes when I show up and I'm trying to do the best for my mom, finding her a nursing home and her sending me 12 or 10 text messages at 9 o'clock at night, calling me every name under the sun, telling me I'm evil and I put her in a horrible home. That sucks. Today I'm able to deal with my feelings and let them do their worst to me instead of rejecting them, pretending they're not here. Because as the Eckhart Tolle says in many of his books and the spiritual leaders, that what I resist persists. Today I'm able to allow those feelings and be uncomfortable in dealing with them, let them land on me. Not that I sink into that black hole of self-pity that's always right here and it's comfortable sitting in the muck going there. But I'm allowed to be sad and tell people I have the feeling of sadness. I'm allowed to tell people I have the feeling of hurt because my mom doesn't love me the way I think a daughter should. Let them land on me and do their worst and I won't have a drink over it because I'm open and honest and I'm able to be vulnerable with you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you people give me the hope that I need because I never walk through anything alone. So the next paragraph, one more suggestion, whether the family has spiritual convictions or not, and here's the principle. They may do well to examine the principles by which the alcoholic member is trying to live. You know, I'm not here to force spiritual principles on my family. But nothing works better than making a demonstration. You know, and our book talks about it numerous times. I'm here to make a demonstration, a maximum demonstration of what it's like to have God and AA in my life. To put principles in front of my mouth, despite how I feel on Thanksgiving dinner, right? They can hardly fail to approve these simple principles, though the head of the house still fails somewhat in practicing them. That right there tells me, I'm not going to be Miss Spiritual AA. I'm going to fail in my household, and I still do quite often. This afternoon, I'm taking a nice nap, and my husband, you know, he just can't sit still, and he's up and down the stairs, washing the dishes, and I'm passed out on the couch, and I just want to sleep. And he's in and out of the living room, he's waiting for me to wake up, you know. And I just feel that emotional rise cropping up through me, like, God, he can't just leave me alone and give me some peace. And then the God steps in between the gaps and pauses in my emotions, where nothing is all about me, 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 me. Right? How do I have compassion for me that maybe I'm not feeling well, maybe I'm not going to be at my spiritual best? And to let myself off the hook for that, but not unleash myself on him, realizing what's going through my head, right? If he just got the memo on, don't you know, I want a little rest and stop doing the dishes because it's annoying me, you know? Here's the next principle. It says, nothing will help the man who is off on a spiritual tangent so much as the wife who adopts a sane spiritual program, making a better practical use of it. Right? And we say in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you want what I have, you'll do what you did. I'm here in my family. I'm not here to force spiritual principles on them, but I'm here to show them what it's like to demonstrate them. It says, there will be other profound changes in the household. Liquor incapacitated father for so many years that mother became head of the house. She met these responsibilities gallantly. By force of circumstances, she was often obliged to treat father as a sick or wayward child. Even when he wanted to assert himself, he could not, for his drinking placed him constantly in the wrong. Mother made all the plans and gave the directions. When sober, father usually obeyed. Thus, mother, through no fault of her own, became accustomed to wearing the family trousers. Father, coming suddenly to life again, often begins to assert himself. This means trouble. Unless the family watches for these tendencies in each other and comes to a friendly agreement about them. You know, we have a sister program, and I've attended many meetings there. And they, like ourselves, they just want some kind of power. They don't like being powerless, just like we don't like being powerless over how you behave. You know, so when we get sober, all of a sudden, we get this little, you know, I'm sober now, and I'm ready to take over and be that person that I should have been all those years. And we come into conflict with our families, and I think this is asking us to have some understanding. You know, in our 11-step prayer, it says to seek to love, comfort, and understand. Well, I was always wanting to be loved, comforted, and understood, you know? And it's telling me I've got to start acting the opposite. It says drinking isolates most homes from outside the world. Father may have laid aside for years all normal activities, clubs, civic duties, sports. When he renews interest in such things, a feeling of jealousy may arise. The family may feel they hold a mortgage on Dad so big that no equity should be left for outsiders. Instead of developing new channels of activity for themselves, mother and children demand that he stay home and make up for the deficiency. You know, this is always just giving me the right size reminder. I did damage, and they want me to be that old person again. You know, I don't even want to be that old person again. I've been given a new character here, and I'm so thankful for that. I've had an awakening to who I really am, which I never knew, which is the glorious words in the St. Francis prayer. Who I really am. I mean, I was the hatred and the wanting to be understood. Today, I am love, comfort, and understanding at the root of me. It's just I'm constantly creating separation, forgetting God exists, and creating that separation between me and my family, me and my fellows, me and you. At the beginning, the couple ought to frankly face the fact, and here's the principle. Each will have to yield here and there if the family is going to play an effective part in the new life. I have a lot of sayings with my husband, and he's caught on to them. I told you, he's an alcoholic too. He's in this program. And I have to say things like, you may be right, when I believe he's absolutely wrong. You may be right, period. Or that's one way of looking at things. Whereas before, if you were wrong, I was going to tell you. If you had a different opinion, see, I tend to think that my opinions, preferences, and judgments are superior and optimal. So let me tell you all about them. Today, I want to cease fighting everything and everyone, as our 10-step promise says. And I have to look at these things. How far away am I from doing this? Am I still yielding or am I telling my husband how to drive? Did I have to get a little dig in, like, oh, you had a people please this morning, and tell that guy that I left the tip on the table? Right? Do I have to point out everybody else's character defects? You know, ego wants to pay any price right now to have relief in saying something. Today I know to sit with that discomfort of wanting to say something. and I don't do damage or not. And I will feel an emotional discomfort from the ego wanting to say something for like 3 minutes, and then it goes away and everything's good and I haven't done any damage. A good way I had to start practicing that, my sponsor every February tells me, you're going to go to the meeting and for the next 30 days you are not going to share anything. You want to talk to a newcomer, you catch him before or after the meeting. You want to share something you heard at the meeting, you catch him afterwards. But that ego in you gets pretty big and thinks, you've got something to share and they need to hear it. How about learn how to be uncomfortable that you want to share something and you're not going to until after the meeting. And I realized how uncomfortable that was for me. So I started to realize what ego does. It wants to prove I'm smart. I know something. I got a little sobriety. I know the big book. Oh, they need to hear me. It's absolutely insane what goes through my head. And so I learned to be uncomfortable with what ego wants to do in having a reaction to say something. And so I still do that today. This February, I will go back to, you know, I'm sorry if you ask me to speak at a meeting, I could speak in March. Because I want to stay right size. I don't have all the answers. I want to practice humility. I can grab you after the meeting if I have something to say. How important is it? I don't have to have all the answers. How about I allow other people in the room to do the God's job instead of thinking it has to be me? The next principle is Father will necessarily spend much time with other alcoholics, but this activity should be balanced. Right? We come into Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning, it's all about AA. I've got to get AA down. I've got to get in the middle of AA. I've got to build a network. I've got to do these things. But I still have to ask myself today, with my family, in the beginning it was like, well, I'll show up for Thanksgiving dinner, but I got to leave because I got to go to an AA meeting because, you know, you guys just bug me, you know? And I'm going to need that. You know, but today I know that I've been relieved of that obsession to drink, thank God. Today I know that I'm asked and I'm called to be a daughter. Can I show up to Thanksgiving and make my AA plans a little more reasonable? Am I staying balanced is what this is asking me in the activity so that I can be the daughter, the wife that I've been intended to be. It says, new acquaintances who know nothing of alcoholism might be made, and here's the next principle, might be made and thoughtful consideration given to their needs. I was never considerate. And like I said in the beginning, it had to be all about AA. But am I being considerate to my family's needs today? Or is it all about what I need? It says, the problems of the community might engage attention. Though the family has no religious connections, they may wish to make contact with or take membership in a religious body. Alcoholics who have derided religious people will be helped by such contacts. Being possessed of a spiritual experience, the alcoholic may find he has much in common with these people, though he may differ with them on many matters. If he does not argue about religion, he will make new friends and is sure to find new avenues of usefulness and pleasure. Right? And I was told to be open-minded, that I didn't have to accept all these ideas, but I didn't have to brush them off either. How this program works is the word that we often hear, but if you read the back of the spiritual experience, it actually says who. Willingness, honesty, and open-minded are those words in that order in the spiritual experience. I try to stay willing, honest, and open-minded. That's what gets me connected to God. That's what gets me connected to God so that God stands in the way and doesn't put up those walls that I have about, well, you don't think like I do. I don't believe those things. You have different religious beliefs. I try to stay open-minded so that I can be useful. He and his family can be a bright spot in such congregations. He may bring new hope and new courage to many a priest, minister, or rabbi who gives his all to minister to our troubled world. We intend the foregoing as a helpful suggestion only. So far as we're concerned, there is nothing obligatory about it. As non-denominational people, we cannot make up others' minds for them. And then here's the next principle. Each individual should consult with his own conscience. And that's the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're not a religious program. You know, we're a spiritual program, and you get to choose the concept of your own God, and we don't sit here and argue about it, and you need to, and you should go to church, and all those things that, you know, if you had said that to me, I would have just walked out the door. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect. But we aren't a glum light. glum lot. You know, when I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, am I making this look like for fun and for free? Or am I showing up with a puss on my face, sitting in the back, not wanting to be bothered by anybody? I'm just here to get my meeting. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. And then here's the next principle, or what I say, God's will for me. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not to indulge in the cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's trouble on our shoulders. And that to me, you know, do I get emotionally charged over politics? Am I bringing that into the meetings with them in my ear? Because we're not dealing with outside issues here. Right? Am I wearing political shirts to the meeting? Am I enjoying my life and looking forward to a time when something changes because that's the only way I'm going to be happy? You know, I have to watch this kind of stuff. You know, I can really indulge watching the news. I stopped watching the news in 2020 when COVID hit because that stuff gave an emotional rise to me. I don't want to, this is a principle to live by, indulge in the cynicism over the state of the nation or care of the world's trouble. Do I believe there's a God out there and God's going to take care of me where I'm safe and protected and you're safe and protected? Or am I running around trying to have debates with everyone? You know, getting that emotional riot up. There's certain people in my family. Boy, is Thanksgiving going to be a trying time with this one for me. And this is where those things come in. You may be right. Period. That's one way of looking at it. Period. I'm not here to express my opinions, but I do get that ego rise that tells me what I think is optimal and superior. And if you're not in harmony with what I think, I'm going to tell you why. Today I let the ego do its worst to me and I come up with those spiritual lines where I'm not engaging, because as soon as I hit the ball to you, you're going to hit it back and we will be playing tennis the entire Thanksgiving dinner. And I'm the one who's going to be disturbed. God's will for me is peace, to insist on enjoying life, to not be a glum lot, to not engage in hitting the tennis ball back and forth to you. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. You know, my job here, we're storytellers in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's why I tell you about what's going on in my personal life and how I'm trying to show up living by spiritual principles. The worst things that happened to me with that IOP. That IOP that was going to, you know, tell my probation officer that I'm not sober and wants to throw me in jail. I never got thrown in jail. But I don't know what's going to happen when I'm going through that. But God has always had a plan for me. And I've got to keep my head right here, right now, feet where my head is firmly planted in the cloud, sharing these things with others who may think that this is the worst situation in the world. God seems to bring me women who are going through similar situations that I get to share my dark past with and tell them that I lived through it, that it was extremely uncomfortable not knowing, that it all worked out in the end. Even if I had been thrown in jail, I would have been okay. And it would have been the consequences of my past, which would have been rightly deserved. Here's the next principle. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness, right? How often do I get uptight? Boy, there's certain people at work I just get uptight around. You know? These are the things that I got to watch for. Because on my own power, that's how Beth shows up to life. And then I can't be useful to you because I'm uptight and I'm just thinking, God, you really bug me. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. God, I love going to diners, especially when we're new and we talk about the worst case things and we sit there and laugh and the waitress gets a little smidget of what just happened about that horrible, horrific event. And we're all laughing about it because that's the gift we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing you're going to tell anyone that's going to shock us. Right? And I get to share this stuff and a lot of people go, yeah, me too. I had one of those probation officers too. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered. and have been given the power to help others, and that's what we're doing here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I said that one phone call. You know, when I'm going through something, it's picking up the phone and going, Jill, how are you? And not talking about all my stuff. You know, I used to get bouts of depression all the time. And it's like, today, I'm not talking about clinical depression. I do not suffer from clinical depression. But I know today when I get in those depressed moods that I can break that depression by calling you and being helpful to you. How are you? And listening to you instead of talking about me. So as everybody knows, that those in bad health and those who seldom play do not laugh much. And here's the next principle. So let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. There again is God's will for me. How far away am I from that? Why am I far away from that? Do I need to write inventory on that to see what's blocking me from that? Do I wear life like a loose garment, or am I constantly worried, living in fear? We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Here's the next principle. Avoid, then, the deliberate manufacture of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate His omnipotence, right? His power, right? How often do I get caught up on the manufacture of my own misery? Because it's comfortable. Because it's comfortable to sit in the muck. Because I did it for 40 years before I got sober. Right? When trouble comes, do I try to get myself out of it? On my own power, my own concept thinking? Or am I turning to a higher power and asking for strength, direction to do the right thing? Am I writing inventory, sharing it with another? Because my own self can't fix self. I can't use self to make a better version of self. This is why it's so important in our fifth step, in our tenth step. It says we share these things with other people. Because they tend to have a perspective that I don't, because I'm emotionally tied to the situation. Now about health. A body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. You know, Bill has told us multiple times in this book, we are not going to get better overnight. Early sobriety, boy, was that a bitch in the beginning. I didn't know how much drama I had going on in my head all the time. Everything was dramatized and catastrophized, and still even today, those things I can get captured by. It's, you know, time takes time. We are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is a most powerful health restorative. We who have recovered from serious drinking are miracles of mental health, but we have seen remarkable transformations in our bodies. Hardly one of our crowd now shows any mark of dissipation. And what a beautiful promise that is in the beginning of our book. I think it's in the fourth step. It says we straighten out mentally and physically before we straighten out spiritually, right? Is that how it goes? Right? And I had no idea, or it's the opposite of that. And I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, when is all this stuff going to come together? But today I am physically, mentally, spiritually healthy most days because I've had a transformation. I'm not the person I was before sobriety. Like you, some of my old friends, I love them, but I am not the same person that can hang out with them. I have had a transformation. Ideas, attitudes, and emotions, which were once the guiding force, have been transformed in me. But this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. Most of them give freely of themselves that their fellows may enjoy sound minds and bodies. Try to remember that though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. Their services are often indispensable in treating a newcomer and in following his case afterwards. I'm not a doctor, and I don't frown upon or give my opinions on what you're doing. If you need, you know, psychiatric help or extra help, that's not my business. That's between you and God today. One of the many doctors who had the opportunity of reading this book in manuscript form told us that the use of sweets was often helpful, of course, depending upon a doctor's advice. right? In the beginning, my sponsor told me about this. She used to carry a bunch of Jolly Ranchers around in her pocket. She said that was helpful. She brought me back to this book and said, here's what we do. It says, he thought all alcoholics should constantly have chocolate available for its quick energy value at times of fatigue. Right? These are recommendations that we give newcomers that are coming in. My grand sponsor used to say that sugar is one molecule away from alcohol. And so carry whatever you need to. And then we all sit around and I would complain about, I'm going to get fat. You know, but sobriety had to come first, you know. He added that occasionally in the night a vague craving arose, which would be satisfied by candy. Many of us have noticed a tendency to eat sweets and have found this practice beneficial. So my sponsor told me, eat all the candy I want. We will, you know, you want to deal with your sobriety first, you gain weight, we can deal with that later. But if you don't stay sober, you may not live. A word about sex relations. Alcohol is so sexually stimulated to some men that they have overindulged. Couples are occasionally dismayed to find that when drinking is stopped, the man tends to be impotent. Unless the reason is understood, there may be an emotional upset. Some of us have had this experience only to enjoy in a few months of finer intimacy than ever. There should be no hesitancy in consulting a doctor or psychologist if the condition persists. We do not know of many cases where this difficulty has lasted long, and I do not have experience on that. The alcoholic may find it hard to reestablish friendly relations with his children. Their young minds were impressionable while he was drinking. Without saying so, they may cordially hate him for what he has done to them and to their mother. Right? We're dealing in reality here. I cannot have fantasy thinking that everybody in the family is just going to align and be happy with me because I'm sober. The children are sometimes dominated by a pathetic hardness and cynicism. They cannot seem to forgive and forget. Oh boy, isn't that calling the pot, getting the kettle black there? I have an inability to forgive and forget, but I want them to forgive and forget. This is where they, like ourselves, are perhaps spiritually sick. This is where I get the compassion. I ain't forgiven them. This may hang on for months, long after their mother has accepted dad's new way of living and thinking. In time, they will see that he is a new man. In time, right? That he is a new man. And in their own way, they will let him know that. Not my way. But I always want things to go my way. This is how they should be treating me. When this happens, they can be invited to join in morning meditation. And then they can take part in the daily discussion without rancor or bias. From that point on, progress will be rapid. Marvelous results often follow such a reunion. Whether the family goes on a spiritual basis or not, the alcoholic member has to if he would recover, right? And that's spiritual direction right there, that I have to live life on a spiritual basis. And then here's the next principle. The others must be convinced of his new status beyond the shadow of a doubt. Seeing is believing to most families who have lived with a drinker, right? Would your family say you behave both physically and emotionally sober? I have to ask myself, am I behaving physically and emotionally sober? Or am I still flying off the handle at every little thing and telling you how to drive and telling you about, you know, you didn't have to tell the guy that we left a tip. You were just people-pleasing yourself this morning, right? Crazy what I can do. Here is a case in point. One of our friends is a heavy smoker and coffee drinker. There is no doubt he overindulged, and this is about a guy named Earl Treat, one of the early AAs. Seeing this and meaning to be helpful, his wife commenced to admonish him about his drinking coffee and smoking, right? He admitted he was overdoing these things, but frankly said he was not ready to stop. His wife is one of those persons who really feels there is something rather sinful about these commodities, so she nagged, and her intolerance finally threw him into a fit of anger. He got drunk. Right? And so here we're looking out for these attachments of these things and wanting to have approval, right? I'm attached to smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee is what Earl Treat's saying here, right? My wife is nagging me to quit and she's attached to him not doing those things, right? And then there's the quarrel, right? And then there's the people pleasing. Well, if she would just get off my back, I would be okay. And so what happens next? It throws him into a fit of anger and he gets drunk. Right? If the wife only realized sobriety was the primary purpose, right? First things first. But I can't make those demands on people. I have to let go of my attachment that other people are going to be displeased with me. That comes up often in sobriety for me, at work, with my family. People are often displeased with me, and it feels really uncomfortable. And when that's a step six and a step seven. I made a really big foul up a couple months ago at work. My boss was extremely upset with me. And then I internalized that I'm the worst of the worst. You know, because alcoholism, what the mind does is the illusions and the delusions. All of a sudden the illusion is that I should never make a mistake, and the delusion is that if I never make a mistake, I'll be okay. As if I'll never make a mistake. Which is completely impossible. I'm a human being who's going to make mistakes in life. But that feeling of somebody else being displeased with me, then that I gotta lie about it, that it was, you know, so that she doesn't think it was that bad, try to cover up my tracks, all the stuff that starts playing in my head that's gonna, you know, fix this up a little bit, or the black pity of, you know, self-pity black hole next to me. I'm the worst of the worst. I should be above making mistakes. If I never make that mistake, see, the truth is that other people are going to be displeased with me, and that's the step six, is realizing that where I default to when other people are displeased with me is really that uncomfortable feeling, is I hate it. It's uncomfortable for me. I want everybody to be happy with me. That's not living in reality. And then in step seven, I have the humility to go to God and say, God, I believe I am lovable even if... ... Even if my boss is displeased with me. Even if someone in my family is displeased with me. It says, of course our friend was wrong, dead wrong. He had to painfully admit that and mend his spiritual fences. Right? I don't know about you, but I've been building walls my entire life around you. The ego, bondage of self, creates these walls of separation. I'm better than or I'm worse than. Right? And when you think about a fence, you can see through the fence, you can see over the fence. Think about a white picket fence. It's not a wall. I'm not putting up walls with my mom anymore. I'm having a spiritual fence so that I can stay on my side of this fence and spiritually get connected with God. But I'm not going over that fence and telling you need to, you should, and I'm not putting up a wall and just cutting you out of my life. I have a spiritual fence that I painfully admit, and mend the spiritual fence, I mend me. Everything is on my side of the street today. Though he is now a most effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he still smokes and drinks coffee, but neither his wife nor anyone else stands in judgment. She sees she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter when this more serious ailment were being rapidly cured. We have three little mottos which are apropos. Here they are. This is where these mottos come from. First things first. I can't rush this process. God and AA are first things first. Live and let live, not live and let Beth. Live my life. Let other people live theirs and experience their own natural consequences. Easy does it. Stay right size. Wear life as a loose garment. Don't take my pride, my preferences, and my judgments too damn seriously. That's Rule 62. So, a lot of principles in this chapter, and this is what I try to go back and, you know, oftentimes I get sponsees and I'll flip through because there's one of these that brings up something that we can be living by. Or I just like to go through this chapter every now and then and pick out a spiritual principle that maybe I haven't been too good at practicing. And maybe that's where my disconnect from God is. And maybe I need to make it into a mantra or just keep asking myself, because when I do those 11-step questions at night, I get to see how far away I was from God, from you, from God, believing that God is in me, providing me wisdom and direction. And so that's why I love this chapter. There's so many spiritual principles in here that I get to see how far away I am from living them and demonstrating them. Thank you so much for having me.